Okay, those are my announcements. And now what I want to do is I want to introduce our speaker, Dr. Ron DePeno. And many of you probably know him, or you've at least heard of him. He is clearly at the top of our rock star list. Ron has presented twice in Houston, once when he was president. He was one of our very first speakers, actually. I think you were like our second speaker, Ron, when he was president and CEO of MD Anderson. And we've had him back post-administrative, and then once in both Dallas and San Antonio. And he's the only person that still remains on our speaker list pre-pandemic. He was planning on going to Austin to speak in December. So fingers crossed, we will still have him back to give us current updates in December. We just don't know where it's gonna be. I suspect it's gonna be probably this format still. So we love him. Ron has had academic careers in at Albert Einstein, the Cancer Institute at Harvard, and MD Anderson. He served as president of MD Anderson from 2011 through 2017, where he launched the Cancer Moonshot program that inspired the national effort. Ron is definitely a serial biotech entrepreneur and founder of several NASDAQ-listed companies. He's now focused on building a biotech ecosystem in Houston, establishing three companies in the last 2 years. Ron currently serves as professor and past president of MD Anderson and a member of the National Academy of Medicine and National Academy of Science. He's published over 400 articles in the areas of cancer and aging. He is founder and chairman of OPA Health, a nonprofit focused on the prevention of disease and in underserved communities. Most information can be found on his new OPA Health website, which I just saw for the first time this morning. It's really, really great. So we will post all that information on our LinkedIn. So Ron DePeno, take it away.
Okay, Linda, thank you. It's great to see everyone virtually. And I do think that this is the format that we'll be using, unfortunately, for at least the foreseeable future. I thought what I'd do today is to talk about COVID, because that seems to have taken all the oxygen out of the room, but really use COVID almost as the equivalent of a Sputnik moment. This is kind of a COVID moment where we have an opportunity to take what is clearly a significant global challenge, a national challenge, and hopefully convert it into things that might have a lasting positive impact. So I'd like to be somewhat optimistic in my pitch here, but I also want to be realistic. And so what I thought I would do is give you more of a high altitude view of where we are, what will be coming down the pike relatively soon, the sorts of issues, solutions that we could potentially put in place. Do that maybe for about 20 minutes and then open it up for discussion. And I really would welcome not just questions, but comments or insights that others may have, so that our collective wisdom could really help us move forward. So first and foremost, where do we stand with the pandemic? It is an absolute straight out pandemic. The national and global picture shows that we're still in the middle of this pandemic. We're nowhere near abating it on a global scale. And in the United States, at best, we're plateauing in some major areas. However, the virus is surging in Japan and Australia, Hong Kong. South Africa is battling one of the world's fastest growing outbreaks. Most US states are, as I mentioned, at best plateauing. And what we're now seeing is that the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast is expected to see significant increases that are happening as a result of the significant hot bed of activity in the lower southeast, like Florida, that is going to be spreading up the coast and so on, given the mobility of our society and folks going from one hot spot to the next, almost the equivalent of a whack-a-mole situation that we have. And I'll speak to that in a moment. Now here in Houston, and I think that's reflective of other major metropolitan areas in Texas, we have recently 1,400 confirmed cases just a couple of days ago. Now that good news is that last week we had a daily average of around 1,800 cases per day. Our positivity rate is unfortunately 16.5% of those tested. You'd like to see a target of 5% or less, because that gives you a sense that you're kind of controlling the situation and so on. But at this point, we have a kind of out of control situation where it makes it very difficult in the absence of a truly coordinated public health response. The Texas Medical Center, which, as you know, is the largest medical center in the world, there we have approximately about 170, 180 new hospitalizations happening each day. Now, the good news, again, is that is down from the mid-200s, around 250 a month ago. And so we're moving in the right direction there. We have maxed out on our phase one ICUs, so they are full, and we're about 12% into our phase two ICU surge capacity use. Phase three is unlikely to be implemented anytime within the next 2 weeks, and hopefully we'll never need it. Hopefully it will decline. Now, we're doing about 10,000 PCR diagnostics in the TMC hospitals. The turnaround is anywhere from a couple of hours to 48 hours. And our PPE capacity is quite excellent. So we have quite a reserve, many days on hand for gloves, masks, gowns, et cetera, which is extremely important to protect our patients as well as to protect our providers and so on. So that's kind of a little bit of a global all the way down to kind of the Houston level in terms of where we are. On the economic level, I think we all know the news. While the stock market is being supported, you know, essentially artificially by the Fed, I think that with, you know, tens of millions unemployed, unlikely most of them to come back given the displacement and changes in consumer behavior. Think hotels, you know, cruises, airplanes, things of that nature, restaurants, etc. I think there's going to be significant unemployment and economic displacement and so on. As a healthcare provider, I'm particularly concerned about insurance. I think many folks who are employed have employer-based insurance. So that, I think, is going to be, you know, unstable, to say the least. So those are some of the, you know, issues, macro issues that we're currently facing. Secondly, if anybody is rustling papers right now, I'd ask that you put yourself on mute just so everybody can hear. Thank you. So with respect to solutions, I would say that, you know, it seems like common sense, but essentially when you think about Desert Storm, for example, or you think about what we did globally with HIV, where, remember, in the late 80s, early 90s, we were talking about HIV as being the greatest societal and economic threat to the world in this century. What did we do to change that trajectory? If you just look at Africa, 250 corporations, every major foundation from Rockefeller to Gates, et cetera, every government in Africa, as well as the rest of the world, focused their attention on bending the arc of that disease. So in a sense, the greatest threat that we have, not just to this virus, you know, and this pandemic, but going forward, is the real issues relating to national and global coordination. If you look at, you know, what President Bush did, 41, with respect to Desert Storm and the coalition that he brought together, You know, that's the kind of response that you have, because even in the United States, where we're a single country, we're operating as if we're many different countries that are independent, with the ability of citizens of those different countries, be in this case states, to be able to go back and forth ad lib and so on. So some kind of coordinated national and global response is critically needed. We've been there, we've done that, we know it works. Secondly, on the individual level, we have to remember the three W's: wear a mask, wash your hands, watch your distance. Now, this is among the most simple things that we could do, wearing a mask. And yet, it's amazing that 22 states still do not have a mask mandate. Why is a mask important? I mean, I know this is obvious. It's spread by, transmission through voice, for example, through those essential means. And so when you wear a mask, first of all, your ability to transmit it to others is markedly diminished. And that's proven. There's extremely strong evidence for that. I mean, the best evidence actually is in the hospitals. The doctors and nurses don't get sick. Why? Because there's a barrier. The patients wear it as well. The patients don't get sick from each other and so on. So first of all, the spread. And it's important to appreciate that there is a very significant fraction of cases that occur as a result of spread from asymptomatic or paucity-symptomatic individuals, particularly young individuals. In addition, if you wear a mask, the severity of disease is going to be less because your inoculum, which correlates with the severity of the disease, is going to be less. So wear a mask. Another important solution is testing. Now, this, of course, has been in the news. I'm very good friends with Brett Giroir, Admiral Giroir, who's the czar for testing. First of all, I think he's done a tremendous job in ramping up. This is a really going from a cold start with the debacle at the FDA and the CDC with these failed tests that launched early, and we lost this critical moment in time. Going from there to now tens of millions of tests is actually quite impressive. However, the turnaround of the tests really needs to occur, and we need point of care testing. You need to know, am I infected? Therefore, do I need to quarantine myself? Should I go to work? Should I send my kids to school? So on and so forth. So I think this is really important for us to get a handle on the testing, the turnaround testing. And optimally, what you'd like would be less than 24 hours turnaround so that you can then have actionable information, et cetera, contact tracing, et cetera, et cetera. And then also, really thinking about with that testing, having adequate quarantine measures in place, particularly in hot areas. This is going to become even more important. We were talking about schooling earlier, even more important with schooling. You know, it's important actually to keep in mind is why did we research? Why did we have this problem? Well, because we didn't follow the opening guidelines. The reopening guidelines really are that you want to have 10 cases per million. We reopened with 5 times that number on average. So it's just simple, 101 virology that, of course, you get resurgence. That resurgence then created a lot of the challenges that we're now seeing when we opened up a little bit too early, et cetera. So I think that we need to have the right kind of focal quarantine that has to be coupled with contact tracing and point of care testing, et cetera. The other thing, obviously, is to do what we are doing as a nation, which is quite inspiring. And here I'd say we get an A+, is to accelerate the antivirals, the antibodies, and the vaccines. I'll talk about therapeutics and where we are in a second. The second is to really accelerate digital health. This is one of those Sputnik aspects, which is, it's my sincere hope that we can use this as a catalyst to really bring knowledge, bring medicine to the individual, to the patient, and as opposed to having them come to the hospital unnecessarily. So of course you need to come to the hospital for many things, but it's important that we really push out as much as possible primary care, prevention, things of that nature. I think this is good for patients and will improve healthcare, particularly for rural areas, underserved populations, and so on. It allows us to use our digital, our healthcare infrastructure more effectively and efficiently. I think another aspect that I'll touch on a little bit more in a moment is building community resiliency. What this pandemic has done is it shined an underbelly, exposed the underbelly of our healthcare system. That we have really not served populations well, and we're seeing a very disproportionately negative impact on underserved communities. Ultimately, we all pay for that. And so building health and wellness, which is pennies on the dollar, relative to the, you know, $10 trillion that we just doled out, is going to be very important. We've got to make an impact. I think that would be the most significant opportunity for us to really do that. And then similarly, when you think about Eisenhower and Eisenhower's response to the Sputnik event, he basically, within months, the educational system of the United States changed. We made massive investments in technology, in STEM education. We changed the nation overnight. And the byproduct of that was one of the most impressive historical runs in technology and, not just the moonshot, but everything else that we really take for granted in this day. So my hope is that 50 years from now, when we look back on this COVID moment, that we'll be in a position to really make an effort along those lines. And then also, if we've learned anything from a public health standpoint as a nation, we've got to be better prepared. We need to invest in basic science. Thank God we're able to sequence the virus within 24 hours. That we had antibody technology that could generate antibodies in weeks as opposed to years. All of these things have had a huge impact on our ability to deal with the pandemic in the, relatively near future. And then we also, in much the same way that we prepare for war games, in case we're attacked, we need pandemic games. We need to be able to prepare for real issues that relate to health and wellness. So let me just touch on a couple of specific points with respect to therapeutics. There are three buckets. One are the antivirals, those medicines that attack the virus or the inflammatory response to the virus. So there, we've got remdesivir. It's not a home run. And we have a couple of other agents that are being worked through. I mean, that will help reduce the severity of the disease in much the same way that Tamiflu helps with the influenza. I'm pretty excited about a small biotech company in the UK that has inhaled beta interferon, which is really helpful. And the results in terms of hospitalized patients going to the ICU, 79% reduction in a pilot study looks pretty intriguing to me. Of course, these need clinical trials. I'm perhaps most excited about a bridge to the vaccine, which I'll talk about in a moment, which shows the neutralizing antibodies. We have convalescent serum, but more importantly, we have monoclonal antibody cocktails. I think the best collection is probably the Regeneron antibody cocktail, where they've developed a collection of antibodies using monoclonal antibody technology. And they got to that very quickly. They're already in clinical trials. And hopefully by end of August, we'll have as much as 2,000 doses to distribute to frontline you know, responders, providers, nursing care residents, so on and so forth. And I might add, I'm a member of the National Academy of Medicine, which is considered to be the most impartial body. We're beholden to no one. We are simply advisors to the nation in matters of health and science. And so we convened a committee. I'm not on the committee, but the National Academy convened a committee to provide recommendations for who should get the vaccine, what the priority should be, so on and so forth. So that'll be forthcoming in August, I believe, by the end of August, for sure. And then on the vaccine front, we have hundreds of vaccines in development. And at last count, I counted 27 vaccines in clinical trials. And I think that I'm very intrigued. What you look for in those clinical trials is you look for the antibody response. And so so far, all of the vaccines to elicit an antibody response, but you also look for a T cell response. Because T cells, you know, do different things than circulating antibodies. But importantly, they're really important for developing memory, immunological memory. So you really want to not only have the reaction to the virus, but you want to have sustained memory that lasts. And the big question, of course, is will it last? How long will it last? Will you need one shot or two shots, et cetera? But some of the data that we can talk about that's coming out of some of the trials shows some promising B and T cell responses. So on the testing front, I think we're making progress. We really have to control our supply chain. We've got to, that's also going to be an issue for the vaccines, by the way, having enough glass vials, needles, you know, things that you don't normally think about, and so on. So I think those are all things that we need to do for testing and turnaround. But I'm pretty excited about a platform that my friends at MIT and Harvard have developed. And it's there's actually a biotechnology company that's spun out of this technology. But basically, it's a CRISPR-based, so a molecular-based technology that can detect all 169 viral pathogens, HIV, Zika, you know, so on and so forth. So I think that that's going to be really interesting for us to be able to use that platform in the future, because actually one of the big concerns going into the flu season is actually figuring out what does the patient have. Is there, you know, does the patient have flu? Does the patient have a common cold? Does the patient have, you know, COVID, so on and so forth, that will make a very big difference. The other area that I think is really exciting, and I guess you'll be talking about this soon, with telemedicine, is really the whole use of artificial intelligence, mobile connectivity, and telemedicine. I think there, you know, the use of AI to push knowledge out to the level of the consumer, having the consumer answer a couple of questions on their phone to figure out whether or not they're at risk or they might have COVID, that pushing out that level of knowledge, not just for COVID, but for basic prevention of disease, management of diabetes, so on and so forth, wearable devices. These are all things that are going to change the landscape of medicine in much the same way that the cell phone changed the way that we communicate. And then last point that I want to make on a global level is the point that I raised about community resiliency. We have tremendous disparities. Your zip code is a more important correlate of your life expectancy than your genetic code. And so it's very important that we do what we can to really shift from a disease care system to a healthcare system. And so this nonprofit that Linda mentioned, OPA Health, is focused on trying to take the knowledge that we have in hand today and apply it in a way that will reduce the incidence of diseases that occur late in life. We focused initially on cancer, and we've moved after speaking to 300 organizations and groups that the gap really exists for being able to address this gap between all this knowledge that we have and actually implementation of that knowledge in a last mile community setting. And importantly, what most folks don't realize is that to change health, you have to begin during childhood. Many of the instigators of disease get planted during childhood. So think HPV vaccination at age 11. The fact that most adult smokers start as children. Childhood obesity and the incidence of cancer later on, or diabetes. Those are really important opportunities for us as a society to focus. Now, one of the things that OPA Health is focused on, and we have a really impressive technology team, is we're actually developing a platform that will allow us to know in a community what are the data. Believe it or not, the CDC data, et cetera, is data that exists at the state level or at a county level. You need to know at a zip code level, a neighborhood level, as to what are the instigators of what disease, what are the issues, and asymmetrically deploy the right services, the right policies to those locations. So this is something that we're building. We're looking for support. If you have philanthropically minded people that actually want to help the underserved, that want to help us build this platform, we would please get in touch with me. We could really use your help. Go to the website, opahealth.org, if you want to know more information. We have an incredible group of people that are helping with us. One or two last points. First, herd immunity. So we're hoping that herd immunity is going to occur. It ain't going to occur anytime soon. That's not going to be a panacea. We have to get the vaccine. So we're going to be in this state until we have the vaccine. And in terms of broad distribution, that'll happen approximately about a year from now. But it'll start to be distributed hopefully by the end of the year, early next year, assuming we have a vaccine that works. The thing about herd immunity is everybody's saying, well, as was just mentioned prior to my talk, you know, some family member gets it and now they're well. The question is, are they immunized? The asymptomatic individuals have very weak immunological responses. And so the question is, are they really protected? And so on. So are they still in play to be reinfected? We don't know. We don't know the answer to that. But just, I think herd immunity is not going to be a solution. And then on one last point is long-term effects. You do not want to get this virus. This virus is not, you know, something that you get and it goes away. There are lasting effects of this virus for many, not all, but many, particularly those that were severely affected. Fibrosis of the lung is something that we saw with SARS in 2003. And 15-year follow-up shows that 30% of those individuals have 20%, at least 20% diminished lung function 15 years out. So fibrosis of the lung, we're seeing a surge in mental health challenge, affective disorders increased. You've got missed screening for cancer. You've got primary care, simple diabetes control, hypertension control. So I'm worried about actually the spillover of folks not seeing their docs. And then the economic stress is something that we all talk about. I think the economic stress, we talked about the lack of insurance, but also the increased drug and alcohol abuse, which occurs with any economic downturn, is something that as a physician, I'm very concerned about. So I'll pause here. I think I took about 20 minutes for that high altitude view, and I'd be more than happy to open it up for a discussion. And we could talk about any topic. You want to talk about biotech, you want to talk about drug development, you want to talk about public health, COVID, cancer, happy to, open up the dialogue. Thank you very much.
Hey, Dr. DePino, I have a question. This is Mark in Atlanta.
Hi, Mark.
Hey. In your opinion, to the best of your knowledge, how did this start? Was it incompetence or was it intentional? And then in your opinion, What are the chances of this happening again, and the best way to prevent it from happening again?
Well, first of all, I don't think anybody knows, how this thing happened in Wuhan. It certainly happened in Wuhan. And as you know, there's a biological laboratory there that works on these viruses. In fact, because there are really huge bat caves not too far away. So, which is a main vector for coronavirus and so on, as you know. So, and there's nothing about the virus and its sequence that suggests that it's an engineered virus at all. So I think that we can kind of probably put that to rest. But the question is, did some careless worker go out into the community or not? Or was it just one of these open markets, where we actually see things like flu, et cetera, emerge from, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't think we know. We know that the origins are likely to be from these bat caves in the Wuhan area that got transmitted perhaps through these open markets. And then I think that the reason why things kind of got off the rails globally is, number one, was I think that our Chinese colleagues were not as forthcoming in indicating how significant a problem this was. I think that the World Health Organization could have sounded the alarm a lot sooner. And I know Dr. Tedros, I have tremendous respect for him. I think that the fact that you have tremendous frayed relationships between nations didn't help. And so that, I think, is another challenge. It's something that I alluded to earlier on. But then in the United States, I got a call from a leader in Congress very early on. This was early March. Asking, is this thing real? So this is one of the leaders in Congress. I think there was just denial. There was not a full recognition, as we did with H1N1. I mean, that was a great example. Or we did with Zika. We went ballistic and we nipped it in the bud. So I think the failure to respect this virus, in contrast to what we did with many other assaults that are occurring, by the way, on a regular basis, but we, nipped it in the bud. I think what we've seen is that because have lack of, coordination internationally, that's an issue. Now, here in the United States, what occurred is that the CDC sent out a test kit that was flawed, and that then got us to lose two precious weeks. The FDA also did not allow laboratory developed tests to enter in to figure out who was infected and who wasn't, in part because the government likes to control the quality and all of those things, and they don't want tests out there that are going to get false positive, false negatives, and so on. But when you have, a pandemic and a virus with an R-naught, high infectivity, you have to respect the virus, and you have to throw everything at it as quickly as you possibly can. So I think that was part of it, how we got here. And then national denial, which we're, believe it or not, still are seeing at many levels, by the way, and I'm not pointing any fingers. But it's, I think that we are inflicting unnecessary problems on people, on country, on the economy. We're going to open up schools. We're going to be way back to where we were, square one. I guarantee you, at the end of September and early October, we're going to be surging much, much more intensely than we are right now, in my view. Hopefully by then, the medicines that we have will be able to, attenuate the mortality and ICU stress, etc. But it didn't have to be this way.
Thank you.
I've heard people theorize that this will become the new flu. Do you anticipate that?
You know, I think that we don't know the answer to that, but I think that we have, first of all, there are two levels to this. One is that I'm pretty impressed with the quality of the medicine's responses against the virus, the neutralizing antibodies, and we'll see with the vaccine, how robust the vaccine is. So the real answer is we don't know, but I'm cautiously optimistic that we will have the medicines and the vaccines to be able to do this. I think what's a greater issue is vaccine hesitancy. You got 20% of people who are reluctant to take this vaccine or will not take the vaccine. And you got 30% of people that are not sure that they want to take this vaccine. To me, that's a bigger risk than will we have the right antibodies to go after the right epitope on the right spike protein. So I think that to me, there's that issue. And then kind of going forward, you know, our species in this very open world is constantly under assault. You know, there was a Nobel laureate that said 50 years ago that the greatest threat to humanity is not a nuclear device, is not, you know, whatever, you know, wars we might think about, et cetera. The greatest threat is a virus. Now imagine this virus is highly infective. It's multiple times more infected than flu, which is a factor 1.3. This is in that 3 to 4 range. Now, the mortality of this virus is going to end up being, you know, at least in the developed world, around 0.5%, maybe a little bit less. And actually now with the medicines, even less. But imagine if this virus was as infective as measles, which has an R naught of over 10, and it was as lethal as SARS, which is, you know, half of the people died, right? And they had lasting consequences. So we're lucky that we didn't get a more lethal virus. And so this is, I don't know if you've ever watched the movie Contagion, but, you know, that's what's out there. And so what do we need? We need pandemic games. We need to be going into these bat caves. We need to ban these open markets. We need constant public health surveillance. We need an infrastructure that allows for contact tracing. We need to prepare, just like we have stockpiles of cruise missiles, we need stockpiles of glass vials or needles or PPE. So those are issues that I think, you know, it's not a matter of, you know, will this happen? I can guarantee you that we will have viruses happening on a regular basis. We haven't seen it as much until relatively recently in recent decades, because we haven't had global travel, cheap global travel in the way that we have. And so the fact that you have, you know, so much traffic going back and forth from one place to the next, it is very easy for this to spread.
And just to follow up on just a quick question, if you could travel by an airplane right now, would you?
I would, you know, if I don't have to, I wouldn't, just like I don't go out if I don't have to. But I think that, you know, if I were traveling commercial, excuse me, what I would recommend would be to double mask. Wear a ski mask goggle, so protect your eyes, and you'll be fine. So I, you know, I think there's no, you know, if you do that, and gloves, and wear gloves, and then when you're done, and you're off the plane, go straight, take a shower, soap up, you know, and if possible, quarantine yourself. You know, for at least at least, you know, 5-7 days, behave as if you're infected. But I would say, you know, it's relatively safe if you take those precautions.
Dr. DePeno, just to follow up on what you said just there. So the goggles, I haven't really heard much, too much about the eyes. We say wear a mask and gloves and things like that. So yeah. Why the goggles?
Far more important, actually. But, you know that, you know, viruses can come in through your eyes, go down your tear ducts and, you know. So, you know, you can rub your eyes or,
right. Or
touch your nose or, you know, put your fingers in your mouth and that's all you need. So I think that, you know, that's why physicians, healthcare providers wear, face shields, you know, to prevent, you know, getting splattered.
Well, face shields for us too would be adequate.
We've and I forget if it's 3 or 5 providers that out of San Antonio that we've made.
Sorry, Dr. Bendine, we missed it. Hello.
I know in El Paso we have been utilizing Moonlighters to support the contracted and affiliated market, and they have stayed as well. I think we have.
Maybe what you can do is in the chat room, just go to the chat box, type in your question, and Linda could convey your comment or question to the rest of the group.
So while Dr. Van Dyne is doing that, Dr. DePeno, there is a question from David Landry, and he says, great update, thank you. Thoughts on hydroxychloroquine and its effectiveness? It seems to have taken over social media this past week.
Well, I think that's an example. First of all, the data from randomized clinical trials, I think, is definitively proven that this is not helpful. So I think we can put that one to bed. That's the evidence. Now, of course, you have to believe in evidence. There actually, believe it or not, there are people that still believe that we haven't landed on the moon. And there are folks that think that the earth is flat. So there's always going to be a fraction of individuals that will believe what they need to believe. And convey anecdotal messages. And especially when it's coming from somebody who, let's say, is a large Twitter following, et cetera, it's really irresponsible. You know, when people say things like, you know, injecting disinfectants and things of that nature, I mean, those are things, you know, we have the surge in poison control centers, you know, and things like that. I think, you know, we have to be very careful as public officials to make sure that we're communicating information that is scientifically grounded. And if we don't know, then we don't know. But what this does underscore is the need for clinical trials, randomized clinical trials, like we did with remdesivir, and we're doing with other, you know, we're doing with the vaccine, and we're doing with the neutralizing antibodies. These are all clinical trials that will say that there's a benefit, there's a risk, and how do we navigate those? But at this point, hydroxychloroquine is a goose egg, unfortunately. You know, I think some really interesting data, and again, this is anecdotal, so caveat emptor. So there's really interesting epidemiologic data that first came out of China that folks who take the ingredient that's in Pepcid, an anti, you know, acid medicine, that it turns out that agent interferes with viral replication, a protein that's important for viral replication. So a good friend of mine is now leading a clinical trial to test that simple, inexpensive drug to see if it's helpful. But it's needs a randomized clinical trial to know whether or not those are important advances.
There's another question in the chat box, Dr. DePeno. Thoughts on genetic re-engineering to get a vaccine faster?
Yeah, so basically the technology, actually the guy who founded Moderna was somebody that I rejected coming to my lab to study at Harvard. So in any event, I'm, you know, my judgment isn't always good. But you know, the example of using RNA as opposed to protein-based vaccines is an interesting example of how investments in basic science allowed us to go from a gene sequence within 24 hours. And here I thank my Chinese colleagues for getting the publicly disclosing the sequence of the virus immediately. That enabled the world to begin efforts that we now, you know, this Normandy invasion on the therapeutic side. So I think that's an example of recombinant DNA technology being used to dramatically accelerate the development of vaccines, et cetera. Another interesting idea on the vaccine front is to actually have infect people with the virus and see if the vaccine works. That would dramatically accelerate the development of the vaccine. That would have been necessary if we didn't have a raging pandemic that we currently have. The good news is that we don't need to do that. I don't, you know, accelerate things a little bit, but the bad news is that we've got an unchecked pandemic. So we have plenty of people in these hotspots that can get placebo, get the vaccine, and then we could study whether or not those tens of thousands of individuals in those hotspots develop the disease or not. I'm very impressed with the responses, the immune responses with the Oxford vaccine. This is a peptide, a protein-based vaccine, really robust antibody responses, but also T-cell responses. So I think that I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll have a good vaccine, but we don't know which one it is. Also, that it will be a safe vaccine. What we're seeing is what you would see with any normal infection. You get, some people get fever, they get soreness at the site of injection, they get muscle aches, like they basically got the flu. And some might say, no, I really want natural infection, the anti-vaxxers. But the, you know, again, I don't know that I want my lung function diminished. A lot of people have had to go on dialysis because the virus also attacks the kidneys. People have gotten strokes from this. People have gotten heart attacks. People have had problems with their mentation and so on. As you can see from the loss of smell, that this thing also affects neuronal circuits. So I don't want to get this virus. I'd rather get the vaccine. So I think so far, so good. But these are all encouraging data, but we need to do a randomized clinical trial. Is it safe and is it effective? The last point that I'll make about the vaccine is it durable? Do we need one shot or do we need a booster shot? We need a booster shot. That's twice the number of vaccines we're going to need worldwide. This is not just a supply issue, it's also a logistical issue. Somebody in a developed world that has to travel 100 miles is not going to go travel 100 miles again for a second shot. So this is a real, real issue, whether it's one or two shots, and whether or not there is durability in the immunological response, or do we need to get the vaccine every year, et cetera.
Dr. DePena, we have lots of questions that have popped up in the chat, so I'll just start. I'll continue going on. Thoughts about Kodak's entry into pharmaceuticals?
About what entry into pharmaceuticals?
Kodak.
Kodak. Oh, well, you know, Kodak is one of the great American icons. They're fantastic chemistry. You know, basically, folks don't realize that essentially they're, you know, Fuji Films and Kodak, et cetera. They're among the most impressive, chemical companies. So, you know, I think that just like when Sputnik happened, you know, the whole country stood up And I think one of the things that's really inspiring is the fact that you have academic labs that have shifted their research focus. You've got foundations being formed like OPA Health. You've got, you know, so many changes in the regulatory framework for the United States, like the FDA, that I think are going to have a lasting impact on the development of drugs. You've got pharma really, you know, coming together, working with government, working with academic institutions. So I'm really excited about the collective will and passion of the world community. I just wish that we had leadership that, you know, brought it all together.
Yes, that would be nice. In a perfect world, if everyone were to wear a mask and do your kind of three W's, wash your hands, wear a mask, and watch your distance, would you open up the economy?
I would. I think we need to balance opening up the economy. We can't not open the economy because the consequences would be as dire as the virus itself. I've always wanted us to bridge to a point where people won't die from this disease. So now with the antibodies and so on, which will bridge to the vaccine, you know, we can begin to open up. But if we all did what you just said, all of us, we would kill this pandemic in 4 weeks. Now, the challenge is the developed world doesn't have the capacity to socially distance, afford masks, and so on. But here in the United States, the EU, and so on, you know, in fact, I wrote an article several months ago, very early on. I looked at the data coming out of, and it's in stat news, I looked at the data coming out of Taiwan, Hong Kong, South Korea, and neighboring countries where the one difference was use of masks as a cultural norm. And the curves were like this versus this. And so every country that routinely wore masks versus those that didn't. So that's just masks. And those are high density populations. So I think that really pushing to wear masks, socially distance where possible, washing your hands, we can have a huge impact on this virus. And then bridge to the vaccine. It's up to us.
Kind of following up on that, Mike Moskowitz of Frostbank says, great insight, thank you. You mentioned a resurgence might happen in September/October, which that scares me. That's my comment is, that's scary. When you said that, that scares me. But what is your prediction about kids returning to school this year and employees returning from home to the office?
Yeah, no, I think first of all, there's no question that the bringing the kids back to school at this point, which I'm in favor of doing that for a lot of reasons, but it's really the timing. But the reality is that because we did not make a decisive coordinated assault over these 6 months, we're now gonna face a situation where we have enough virus in the community that for sure, I'd be willing to place any bets with anybody on the call, for sure, we are going to have a resurgence that's gonna make this past resurgence look like nothing, because all of these kids are gonna go back. All of these kids are going to go back to their schools. Folks, mom and dad are going to go to work, and so on and so forth. So I would just, as I predicted a month ago, 6 weeks ago, when we were opening up, when we had 40, 50 cases per million, as opposed to the 10 cases per million, that it just, of course, the virus is going to do what it's going to do. It's not rocket science. This is very simple common sense. It's like expecting to put your hand into a fire and not be burned. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to me that you would put yourself in a situation where virus exists, it gets transmitted by people speaking, a lot of asymptomatic spread, to expect there not to be a surge after the schools open up, I think is very naive. But we just need to expect that. And hopefully the medicines will be better.
Well, I'm glad that you said that we should expect it, because now it kind of gets, we can prepare ourselves mentally for that.
Wear a mask now.
I do. I think we all.
I'm not saying now, but you know, wear a mask. You know, as a routine thing. Now, especially actually when your kids start coming back and forth from school, you know, I think households are gonna, now if testing is really ramped up, now I think there's smart testing strategies, like where you do pool testing of classrooms and things like that. Like just like the baseball team, the Marlins had an outbreak. They knew that within a day. And now they can, you know, go on a 6-day quarantine, okay? So if we can get testing done at a level, then we can go back to work, back to school. If there are outbreaks, we can shut it down and then go back, right? So that's really what we need. We need that infrastructure, but to have a high rate of infection in the community and a lack of actionable testing, that's just we're going to be back to square one.
There is another question that I like. This is Linda, and it came from Mark. I don't know how to say your last name, Mark. Thoughts on how far away we are, this regards to testing, from reasonable cost, rapid response test results, especially, and this regards you, I mean, we know you famously in the cancer world. We haven't talked much about cancer, but especially for cancer treatment centers who want and need to see patients in person and would benefit from test results within a short waiting time period.
Yeah, I think that the testing is gonna dramatically improve in the coming months. Admiral Jawar, you know, has been giving us regular updates on that. And I think some of the new technology that's coming out, I think is gonna really enable point of care, rapid turnaround, so on and so forth. I think I'm actually more concerned about whether or not we're going to have the contact tracing infrastructure to be able to follow up and so on and so forth, given privacy concerns, et cetera. So back to testing of patients and keeping them safe, and cancer patients in particular, which, by the way, cancer patients have an order of magnitude greater mortality if they get COVID relative to the general population. So this is a very significant risk for death. So I think we got to keep that in mind. Why? Because they're immunocompromised. They're undergoing treatments that weaken their immune system. The cancer itself may weaken the immune system and so on. So at MD Anderson and other cancer centers, we are actually, patients that come in are tested first. When they come in, they wear a mask. Everybody wears a mask. So on and so forth. So these are all precautions that protect our patients. And what we've done, and I hats off to Peter Pisters, the current president of MD Anderson. He exceeded the CDC guidelines from day one. And he built essentially a moat around MD Anderson, where we are very, very careful about having, you know, the ability of individuals that might carry the virus to come into the setting, so on and so forth. So I think that cancer centers have implemented similar strategies, and we are, we're doing our best to protect our providers and protect our patients. What I'm more concerned about is the fact that, you know, with the lack of elective procedures, and, you know, these aren't just facelifts, you know, these are like real, like, you know, hip replacements and, you know, really important things, or people getting mammograms or colonoscopies. you know, it's estimated that as a result of not getting cancer screening, there may be as many as 10,000 more deaths that will occur from the lack of screening that's happened so far, simply because those cancers will be caught a little bit later and not as curable. So I think that, you know, I worry about that. I worry about, you know, diabetics not getting their glucose checked. I worry about hypertensives not getting their hypertension under control and getting strokes and heart attacks. So it's those things, those kind of secondary impact, mental health. Those are the kinds of things that I think I'm very concerned about.
I have a quick question about cleaning standards and what should be the new norm. I've seen restaurants rent like Xenix robots to do cleaning standards. What is your overall recommendation?
I think, you know, common, so for, it's really two things. One is air circulation. So outside versus indoors is a 16-fold difference in your risk of getting infected. So if you're indoors in a restaurant, good air turnover, just like in an airplane, it's HEPA filtered and so on and so forth. So open the windows. Do something as simple as that. Fans, you know, those kinds of things I think will help. Or sit outside if you're going to a restaurant. And then I think it's really common contact surfaces. I think, you know, doorknobs, you know, things of that nature, the table and so on. So you want to really wipe those down and just be careful not to have your hands, you know, physically touch your face. And then it's important for the workers, the providers to, you know, get tested on a regular basis and so on. I think, you know, the notion that temperature checking, which of course we should do, or asking a couple of routine questions, the most important of which, have you lost smell or taste? You know, I think those things are really, really helpful. But let's keep in mind that, you know, as much as 40% of individuals are asymptomatic or pauci symptomatic and are infectious. So got to keep those in mind.
Can I ask a quick question? Brian Novy, and you mentioned indoor, outdoor, and so forth. And of course, I'm in real estate, and I keep thinking, you know, Google made the announcement today that they're not going to have their workforce actually go back a year from now. I think this is going to drastically change, you know, a lot of these tech companies, Facebook, you know, Google, Apple. It's all about collaboration and being close together and working together. You know, I mean, I'm concerned, you know, you mentioned about air quality and social distancing. I think that's going to be a huge challenge in the office buildings with landlords. And
I agree.
Do you have any thoughts and ideas about what owners can do to their, I guess it's, you're talking about their air filtration and trying to deal with that.
Yeah. Air filtration, having people, what we do in the labs in my lab at MD Anderson is that everybody wears a mask, you know, that allows folks to come together. We don't have meetings, you know, physical meetings where everybody gets together. We do that on Zoom. In fact, just before this, I had my weekly lab meeting. So, you know, I do think it's, you know, as a social being, as a social species, I think we really do need interaction, physical interaction, contact, so on and so forth. But, you know, there's no question that this is going to dramatically change the landscape, use of real estate, all kinds of things, the design of buildings, things of that nature. I think this is going to have, you know, as big an impact as, you know, electricity or, you know, the telephone or what have you. You look at the usage of Amazon or delivery, you know, Dash or, you know, any of those services. It went from something like low single digits to 30-40% in the population for delivery of groceries and all sorts of things. I think that in some respects, I've given, I don't know how many lectures since the pandemic began. And, you know, I didn't have to get into a taxi or a plane or, and it was, you know, easy and it was terrific. And actually, I think I think it's safe to say that there's virtually no difference. If anything, it was better. So I think that there are going to be real changes. I think people are not going to travel as much. Things like Zoom are going to be the conferences of the future. We just had the big annual cancer conference of 20,000 people where folks presented online instead of in an auditorium with casts of thousands. And it was great. So I don't know. I think things are going to change, but we certainly need to have continued interaction. We need to have folks coming to work, so on and so forth. I'm actually mostly concerned about the children. And, you know, I don't think that a five-year-old who needs to learn socialization is going to do as well, you know, online versus actually being in a classroom. So I think that these are real issues that we're going to have to grapple with. But certainly it's going to have a huge impact on how we interact with each other.
I just want to ask you one other quick question about cancer. Since the whole world is focused on the pandemic and billions of dollars are being, you know, invested in this, and how is this affecting cancer funding, cancer research? How are we moving along in the I don't know how to say cure for cancer, but cancer is a serious thing, but like it's, you don't hear much about cancer, you know, heart disease, all this other stuff. COVID is just dominating the world right now.
Well, it is. And I think it's going to serve a catalytic role on some levels. I alluded to the FDA and things of that nature. I think one of the things it did have an impact on clinical trials. Now we're resuming those clinical trials. So that I think it was a speed bump, but hopefully, you know, regulatory facilitation and so on the back end will make it even better. I would say that, and I alluded to this, and I'm actually co-founder and vice chairman of ACT for NIH. This is an advocacy group that is supporting Congress's support for the NIH, which is the world's most successful research agency in the history of humankind. All of the things that we just talked about came out of NIH research. And so I think that what we'll see in the Congress's budget, which is still, we're still making the sausage, but what we'll see is a significant increase in support for research. And I might add that, you know, we talk about cancer research, but actually a lot of the stuff that we did for cancer in addressing cancer actually is helping the COVID situation. You know, we understand how the immune system works better because we spent so much time on cancer immunity that we are taking those knowledge and lessons and medicines and moving it to the COVID space. So there's a lot of interactions across all the different disciplines. But I believe, just like the Sputnik again, I think the nation is going to wake up and realize that we should spend as much money each year on research for not just cancer, but many diseases. And you know, at least do what we do for, you know, building a couple of cruise missiles. You know, we're talking about significant advances that could occur, that could accelerate. We're going to spend $1 trillion in today's dollars by 2050 on Alzheimer's alone, if we don't come up with a cure for Alzheimer's by then. So we really have to invest, you know, these pennies, you know, relative to the problem. And so I think that that's going to be important. And I do think that cancer, you know, when this pandemic ends, we will have lost many, many more people to cancer. In this coming decade, we're going to lose 100 million people globally to cancer. And then there's diabetes and heart disease and so on. It's similar. So if we just put it in perspective, there is a tremendous need for us to come together as a community and make an impact.
Sorry, Linda. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, we see these pictures of long lines waiting for hours and hours and hours. It's like panic time to get the test. Do you believe if you don't have any symptoms that we should go out and get the test? You do?
I think, if you're in it's a combination of things. If you're in a high risk area, or you have teenage kids that went to a concert or, you know, have come back, or, your dentist calls you back to say one of our patients tested positive and you were in the same room being treated by the same dentist. I mean, you know, these factors, at this point, getting tested is extremely helpful, because if you're positive, you can quarantine yourself. So I think that I would have a low threshold for testing. And then the most important things are the three W's.
You mentioned talking about self-quarantine when you were flying for 5 to 7 days, or when the Marlins had their outbreak, a similar time frame. A lot of folks have family in different places, and different families have very different definitions of infection control. So when you're trying to get together, what recommendations do you have for folks about self-quarantining before you group families together in a setting? Is it 2 weeks? Is it 5 days?
Well, you know, the advantage of the Marlins and why it's only 6 days for them is that they got tested and they knew that they converted. So the problem with not getting tested is that there is a period of 3 to 7 days before you can get symptoms. So by getting tested each day, you can find out exactly when you got infected. And then you could say that, well, my immune response over the course of a week. But in general, you want to be afebrile for several days and asymptomatic, no coughing and so on. So, and then if you travel, or if you're in a hotspot area and you want to get together, as my family does, we do Sunday evening Zooms, to say hi and, you know, talk to each other. Actually, we've seen each other more in the pandemic than not. But when people get together, they just sit apart and they're outside on the porch. So there are common sense things that you can do. And especially if you're the one that's traveled, that you want to basically do that and wear a mask. You don't want to get this virus. So the inconvenience of wearing a mask versus pulmonary fibrosis or dialysis, I don't know.
There were a couple of, we're almost out of time and we've got some questions that are in the chat box. Let's see, first of all, I want to say Elaine Dolacek, she had to leave early. To get another call, thought your direct and knowledgeable answers on this topic were wonderful. Breath of fresh air, thank you for the group. Another one, I don't hear many recommendations for distancing within homes. And this is from David Waldron. My wife contracted COVID and shared with two others in our home before she was tested. How much of the spread is within the home setting? And I think we know it's pretty bad.
It is. It's a contained space. You're constantly interacting with each other. You know, and I think that's the problem for most of the world, is that folks live in relatively confined spaces. They don't have, you know, mansions where they can, you know, stay in the West Wing, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is a big issue. And the one thing that you can do, just like I think when you have a cold, Mm-hmm. You know, if you stayed away from that person, washed your hands, and on top of that, wore a mask, you do well.
Okay. Is there, Leslie Brennan, still difficult finding test sites for antibody testing? One of her coworkers is having this issue. How quickly is it expanding locations?
Well, you know, we were expanding, and then the federal government just a couple of weeks ago, when the number of cases were going up a lot and there wanted to be a containment of that rate of increase, they actually were talking about cutting back on the testing sites. I think they backed off on the 13 federal sites in Texas. But I think it's going to improve quite a bit over the next month, but we're not there yet.
What country, this is from Scott Collins, what country, is there any country doing testing right? If so, which one and why?
South Korea, Germany, many. I mean, they were prepared. Uh-huh. The SARS experience that South Korea had. But the other thing they did in South Korea, which we're not going to do in this country, is, you know, they followed you on your, and Taiwan was another one. They follow you on your iPhone. Your phone. And so that helps with contract tracing. You know, imagine, you know, I don't remember exactly who I saw when, but you could easily, you know, see that, but that's surveillance that the US, I don't think, would ever adopt. Mm-hmm. Now, MIT just came out with an algorithm that allows for anonymous contact tracing, so at least the person and others can understand that this is a potential issue, but this is a big difference between us and the rest of the world. But South Korea was well prepared, Germany as well. I think Singapore. One of the things that they did is that the scientists ran the show, not the politicians, mm-hmm. And so, you know, they were the ones that were in charge of delivering the message. And they were front and center in dictating, you know, how things came about.
Also in Vietnam, I don't think they've had a single death in Vietnam, from what I understand. But they just mandate, and everybody follows the rules. They mandate masks everywhere. So is there another question? We probably have time for one more question. It's right up at 1 o'clock. But if somebody wants to jump in with a question, we'll take it. Otherwise,
I will. This is Scott. The mask, we know it helps prevent the disease from spreading from an infected person, but common sense dictates that it would have some effect on a person wearing it from getting the disease if there are airborne particles and so forth. Can you talk to that?
Yes, that is correct. And on top of that, it diminishes the inoculum of the virus. So there's evidence that if you did get infected, the severity of your disease could be less. So I think for every reason, you should wear a mask. It's crazy that we're debating this. I don't understand. If you breathe, that's a risk factor for this disease. So you either don't breathe or wear a mask. That's my.
So if it helps protect you, it seems like that would be a little bit more in the media attention on this, to show people to protect yourself, wear a mask versus to protect others. Because I think
that's true, but I hope that we can rise to a higher level of, you know, humanity. I think there were two things that happened in the Sputnik moment that was really inspiring. I talked about the technology, but the other thing that happened to us as a nation is that we came together. Everybody tried to figure out how to fix this thing. It wasn't, there was no, oh, you let Russia get ahead of us. There was none of that. It was, okay, we have a problem here. We were just beat by, you know, an entity that is not our friend. And what are we going to do? Well, we did two things that really changed who we are. We respected science and invested in it, and we respected each other, and we helped each other. We came together as a nation. It is my hope that we can bring us to a higher level of respect for science and community health so that we can help those that need it the most and improve the health and well-being of this country and others, and that we can come together as a people and just be nicer to each other, more respectful.
Okay, we're out of time. I think all of us agree that this was an outstanding presentation. We thank you so much, Ron, for spending an hour and a half with us. And we will post on our LinkedIn all your contact information. Well, we don't... I'm not going to give out your cell phone, but your online contact information. People can follow you on Twitter and your other companies. Okay. So good luck, be safe, and thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Pena.
Thank you. Very good.
Thank you.